Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today I'm going to be joined by Martin Grahams, and we're going to be discussing the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I just want to remind everybody that the Nostalgia Convention is going to be from September 7th through the 9th of 2023 at Hunt Valley Delta Marriott in Hunt Valley, Maryland. You can go to the MidAtlanticNostalgiaConvention.com website to find out more information and to get your tickets. One thing I want to correct, during our conversation that we did a little more than a month ago, Martin and I were talking about some of the celebrities who are going to be there. And as we mentioned during that talk, sometimes things change because they get jobs in theater, other things happen, life happens. Haley Mills will not be at this Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. We'll be talking about her during that, but I just want to let everybody know she's not. But some people that we did not know at the time they're going to be there are George Hamilton. Just want to let everybody know that. And Joanne Cassidy. So they were recent additions. So like always, there's people that come and there's people that go, but there's a lot of people that are going to be there. Most of them we're going to be mentioning in discussion that we talk about with the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. But just to let everybody know, come on, have fun. Hope to see everybody there. And give everybody an idea what is going to be happening. Let's go right into the episode with Martin Grahams and myself. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today we have a special episode where we're going to be talking about two different things. One, the movie On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And the other thing, one of my favorite conventions, the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, which is going to be taking place September 7th through September 9th, 2023. And I'm joined with the Grand Poobah of the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, Martin Grahams. How are you doing today, Martin?
Doing good, Steve. Glad to be on the program. And just for the viewers, I just got over bronchitis. So as the listeners are hearing, if you hear me occasionally sipping a nice cup of hot tea, it's not a bad thing.
Things happen, and we find our ways to work around them. You know, that's just the way life goes. And we're going to talk about Her Majesty's Secret Service in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk about the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. You and I, you've been on the show a couple times before, and your show is 15 minutes from my house. So I know, unlike a lot of people that are listening to this, I'm very close to the show. And I love going there because your show, different than some other conventions, is a wide variety of stars and mediums.
Yeah, I always like to say it's a Comic-Con for old people, in that it's pop culture related, it's a little diversity, so you get some Bond girls, you get TV legends, you get movie stars that are icons, and then you get the smaller names that you would never think of that actually did something historic in movies. So like a little bit of variety, and I always like that. And so it's kind of, I wouldn't say I run it on the grounds of what would I like as a pop culture geek, but it's put on basically for what would the attendees enjoy. But it does kick into that to where people can just, you know, spend 3 days going through a bunch of collectibles from the merchandise, from the vendors, and meeting the stars and asking questions and having that 15 minutes brush of fame, get their autograph, have their photo taken with them, go see some rare films, and including this year, we're even screening a couple rarities we just added to the thing. So, and slideshow presentation. So it's basically 3 days of fun, and some people equate it to that being their Disney World of the year.
It is fun, and there's two things unique about your convention compared to most conventions. One, you start on a Thursday and end on a Saturday, and which I find nice because it gives you Sunday to recover from doing all that stuff for all those days. And if you're traveling, it gives you that perfect travel day to go back home, wherever state you're coming from.
Correct. They can be back at work on Monday. So whether they were off a day earlier in the week or taking a day off later in the week, it's, you know, just kind of offsets equally. But believe it or not, we're not the only ones that do that. And it actually was for that particular reason. Western Cowboy Film Festival, Silent Film Festival, a lot of them, they actually took place Thursday, Friday, Saturday. They never did a Sunday. And I firmly believe, I never did ask them, I believe it's because they were, a lot of those Cowboy Western Film Festivals was more of a Christian crowd that preferred to have Sundays off. So by Saturday, 12 noon, it was pretty much done, and everyone's packing up and heading out, and then those who came for the weekend would come in like Wednesday night, like some of them doing our show here, just to be able to mingle and meet up with the people they see once or twice a year. So that's kind of why we did it originally. I know we did a Sunday one, might have been year two or year three, and Sunday was dead. And we realized, okay, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the crowd that comes to our show. Now, that crowd could have evolved over the years. We might try a Sunday one day, but I think we're still good set for Thursday, Friday, Saturday. It seems strong even on Thursday.
Oh, Thursday is one of my favorite days because you show up and everything. It's just, I don't know, it's just nice. And sometimes it's a good day to be there because people are still at work or they haven't made the trip up because they're coming for the Friday, Saturday. So you can get there on Thursday and you can be a little bit of ahead of the curve. It's like each day has it caters to a different group of people.
And also, I know that people come in on Saturday, work Monday to Friday, they're local. They're just coming in, they meet the celebs, wander the vendor room and leave. They're not spending, because if they're coming in on Saturday, they're not there for the slideshow, seminars, or the movie room. So much of what we schedule for this that Saturday in the events and the movie room is primarily for those who have been there all weekend, have already met the stars, already pillaged the vendor tables, and at this point, they're just enjoying the rest of the weekend, laid back, relaxed, even going to the dinner banquet on Saturday night. And then they leave on Sunday because of the distance and trip. So I think Saturday, you could tell there's a different crowd in certain rooms. And then over at the celebs and the vendors, it's just this mad rush for people who come in for a few hours on Saturday. So we kind of schedule the seminars and events for Saturday, primarily for the weekenders who are more interested in some of the academic aspects. Whereas we know that crowd coming in on Saturday wouldn't, but they could come in on a Friday night and see a movie screening and a celebrity Q&A right before the movie, you know, something to come in, you know, get off work, drive over and check in the night before just to enjoy something before, you know, hitting the bed and enjoying all day Saturday.
And the other thing that I said that's unique to you, or like I said, being when I say the word unique, some other conventions might do this too, but you're a nonprofit convention and all the money you raise goes to St. Jude's.
Correct. The way the business model is, in a 501, is that a certain amount of the money expense we have for expenses. And then once the expenses are covered, the difference that's left over, a percentage of that is put aside for growth of the next year. And then the rest of it gets donated to the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. During the weekend, there's also a charity auction, and all that money also goes to the Children's Hospital. So I think we've only taken a loss year one and year two. And then I think we took a loss, it might have been 2021. It was the year that we had the stands and all that. But it was no big harm in a sense that we still was able to do a contribution and help out. But I've always said profits is not the intent of actually running any type of business. And make no mistake, a convention is debits versus credits, so it's a business. It's beneficial that you have a goal in mind and then the profits are used as a gauge to see how good you're doing the event. So I've always said, if you run any business, don't do it for the profit. Do it for whatever agenda or goal, whatever that community event, whatever it is you're trying to do for some charity. Do something that gives you purpose and reason. And it also helps not just with the volunteer staff, but in a regular company. The paid employees are not coming in just for the paycheck. They're coming in with a motivation and a reason to work. The paycheck's just incidental. And it's kind of like a different way of living, but it works out with less stress and everybody wins in the long run.
I find it a very fun convention, family friendly, laid back. But I know a lot of people are probably saying, well, there's one thing we're almost 8 minutes in and we haven't talked about any of the guests that are coming. And just one thing I want to let people know is these are the guests that are scheduled to be there, but as anything can happen, life happens. Sometimes a scheduled guest can't come because of personal reasons or work reasons. So when we say these names, they're signed, they should be there, but life does happen.
Yes. And we've always made sure it's family friendly oriented. We've kind of had a strict line going across of anybody who wants to create a hostile environment. And I guess no convention's immune to it, but I think twice in 10 years we've had a moment where we had to have security escort somebody out and off the grounds. And tell them if you want to put on your big boy pants and behave tomorrow, you're more than welcome to come back. Otherwise, thank you for coming today. And, it's like, this is a family oriented, people shouldn't have a problem dropping off their kids in the Saturday morning in the movie room to watch vintage cartoons for an hour and feel safe knowing that their kids, nothing's going to happen to their kids. Cause you know, even somebody at the staffing is sitting in that room, just making sure that the kids aren't wandering out of the room and wandering a hotel and nobody knows where they're at. So it should be family oriented.
And you have wonderful volunteers, and I've met a lot of them over the years, and your staff is just dedicated to helping everybody have a good time and making sure that that they get a chance to do the activities they want to do whenever possible.
Yeah, and we've actually gotten lucky on that, and I rarely recruited anybody personally. I'd say every year I get about a dozen people who will send me an email, hey, do you need any volunteer staff? And the moment I say yes, or before I even say yes, they all seem to have the same response. Oh, good, does such and such celebrity need them to sit with them? And I realize they're not there to help the convention. They're just wanting to sit down with a celebrity for the weekend. And that tells me it's a red flag, because the celebrity is not there for the person who's sitting next to them. It's for the person across the table to answer their questions they've always wanted to know, get the answer straight from them, sign the autograph, the chit-chat, whatever. So it's very hard. They always say it's tough to find good help these days, and that's the scenario that happens. Most of our volunteer staff usually came around. Somebody was just there like, hey, it's my husband's thing. It's not my thing, but this needed to be done, so I just jumped in and did it. And I was like, oh, they're not a complainer. They're a doer. Want a shirt? Or somebody knew somebody who was a volunteer staff who got another person. They said, she's a friend of mine. Trust me, she's good. And we've been lucky. We've had a fantastic staff that just, they're there for the attendees. They know that anytime they have to make a judgment call, whatever is best for the attendee is the best answer. It doesn't matter, what it involves. And so I consider myself lucky and blessed that we have such staff that we do. They've been really good at doing, whatever makes the convention run smooth.
And I know you have a ton of guests coming. There's several people I'm really looking forward to meeting that I've never met before. And being the guy that watched Barney Miller growing up, you have Hal Linden and Max Gale coming. And I'm just really excited that you were able to get those two.
To be fair, I've never seen Barney Miller, but I knew who Hal Linden was, and I learned who Max Gale was. I figured it's like I said, I don't run it for myself. I run it for the attendees, and figured the attendees would love to meet Barney Miller. So he's going to be a fun hoot to be there. He's also up there in age, so I'm actually giving kudos to him for, I think he's 92. I might be wrong if I'm off by a year. Just for him to be in traveling at that age to come out and meet fans. I always tell people the celebs are not there to make money, but the celebs really do go out of their way to come see the attendees, not just, parking, putting the dog in the kennel and paying for parking to have their car at the airport when they fly out. Someone's 92 years old and flying in from California, that actually can be pretty rough on somebody by that age. So I give kudos for somebody like him to make that effort to come out and meet the fans.
Oh, I do too. And thank you for, reaching out to them and getting them to come.
Yeah, I remember, I think we had Jamie Farr last year, and Jamie Farr called us sometime before and said, can I ask a request? Can I come in one day earlier? He said, I'll pay the extra night in the hotel, et cetera, because at my age, flying all the way out there and I need a wheelchair to get to the airport because it's so long. You can't have a lot of walking. And he goes, I need the day to recoup, so I'm 110% from the fans. And I said, no problem. We took care of that. So it was a small, subtle reminder to me that, at a certain age, it does get tough for some people to get on an airplane and fly out to meet fans. And sometimes I think the fans forget that a little bit, that how much effort, the fans make a lot of effort to get to the show. The celebs do themselves. So I always assume everybody has a fun time over the weekend and doesn't take anything for granted.
Now, you just announced somebody who's coming who ended up, I think it was the COVID year where things all went awry, couldn't make it and stuff like that. But Haley Mills, Juliet Mills, the Mills sisters are coming. I mean, I'm really excited about both of them.
And Juliet and Maxwell Caulfield. Yeah, Haley's on my list of top five. I was very pleased that she sent an email and said, yeah, I can. I think I can do it. That she didn't want to confirm so too far early because she's doing stage in England. And at present, she just found out she is not doing stage in England in September. She said, of course, anything can change, but she just loves doing stage. So the moment someone approaches her with a new play and she reads it and says, I'll do it, if rehearsals start in September, we lose her again. But at this point, it's not like we're promoting her in 8 months in advance. This is about 60 to 65 days before. So the chances of her canceling now is close to zero. So I feel more confident. It's like this is going to be the year that we get to finally meet her, hear the stories. And I'm going to wager she was – it's funny. I've read up a good bit about her. I've read much of her biography about her and her father, John Mel. I've seen the movies she did other than the Disney films. And I got to tell you, I think she's – you ever heard those kinds like Natalie Wood who are above the league for most people? She's going to be a fascinating guest to talk to because she's probably got a very grounded approach to what she looks at from different perspectives. And in other words, most people can come in from Hollywood and give you a story and it's cute. Some could tell you, let me tell you a little thing called match. And they go, what's match? Well, when you're filming, you do this and this. That's referred to as match. And you go, I learned something new. From her perspective, I sincerely believe we're going to learn from Haley Mills a little bit more behind the scenes on the evolution of movies and the types of movies that she had accepted in her life, which is not expected. People look at her as a Disney girl, but you look at those movies. She's a little girl who's hiding a hobo out in a barn, and she believes he's Jesus Christ, literally. There's a movie where she's coming of age. She's sleeping with men who she's not married to or trying to have a honeymoon on a weekend. The parents are being too intervening. And it's one of these type of movies you're sitting there going, wait, this is Haley Mills. And then I forget she wanted to do these types of movies for a reason. So I think people are going to find out she was more than just the Disney princess they think they know her of. And it would be really cool that they get to reevaluate a different part of celluloid history that, from her perspective, is how movies should be made.
Exactly. And one of the things I want to remind people is when you're there, especially if you're there for multiple days, there's times when their tables are busy and there's times when their tables are not as busy, you know, feel free to ask them questions. I mean, a lot of times they're, as you said earlier, almost all of them are coming to talk to us, the fans, and they appreciate us because it's one of those things. They wouldn't have had a career without us and we wouldn't have had the enjoyment without them. So it's a mutual satisfaction. And a lot of times they like to hear feedback from us, and sometimes you never know. Well, there's a question you might bring up, and it brings back a memory that they haven't really talked about in a long time, and that's the fun thing. It's when you rekindle some of those memories that they've had buried, and you bring them back.
Yeah, and it's nice that they hear stories. Some people like, say, Robert Fuller, who was from the TV show Emergency, or we had, I think, Kent McCord from Adam 12, and how many people who became doctors, lawyers, or police officers, and it was because of the TV show that after so many years they said, I want to apply for that type of job, and that became their career. And it's nice that the celebs who thought it was a job at the time now look back and they hear people telling them, dude, I became a police officer because you, I saved 14 lives in 30 years I worked, yada yada. It's the stuff that it pays it forward 100 times more, and it really is gratifying for the celebs. So it's not just the attendees who actually get a great weekend. The celebs going home are reminded that they were a bit more than just an actor in front of a camera.
I 100% agree with you there. And for anybody that grew up in the 70s like I did, you have a couple of actors coming that, you know, I'm really, really looking forward to. Nicholas Hammond, Spider-Man, and Ellen Bry.
Yeah, Ellen Bry's got a very interesting career off the side as a stuntwoman, not just as an actress. But Nicholas Hammond, he's flying in from Australia. So it's not, when someone says, why doesn't he do many shows? Well, he's coming in from Australia. And we found out his mother doesn't live too far away from there, so that was a no-brainer. And he was perfectly fine. He forgot about time zones, so he's only there Friday, Saturday, because he flies in on Thursday instead of Wednesday, which is no big deal. People who know The Sound of Music or Spider-Man, the TV show, will get an opportunity to meet him in person. So it is kind of a rare opportunity. And then he called Ellen Bry, and Ellen said, I'd love to do the show. And she's got great photos where she's next to Margot Kidder, and she's literally wearing the Lois Lane suit because she was a stunt woman for Margot Kidder in the Superman movies. So she's got these great photos of her standing next to her and then some of the stunts that she was doing. And I was like, wow, she's got a little bit more than just being the sidekick for Spider-Man on TV and all these other movies. She was also, technically, she was Margot Lane.
Yeah.
No, sorry, not Margot Lane. Lois Lane.
Lois Lane. I know what you meant. But, I mean, it's just amazing. And, I mean, the list is it's a long list. But I will say you have one person making their debut in conventions. And a lot of people probably don't know much about her. You know, Ellie Woodwalker. So you want to inform people what Ellie Woodwalker is known for.
Yeah, every year we like to have one star who's what I call the novelty. Like we had Marley Renfro one year, who was Janet Leigh's body double in the movie Psycho. So she was in Alfred Hitchcock's film. She was the nude woman that was in the shower during the certain cuts that wasn't Janet Leigh's face. So it was like, this is the woman who got stabbed in the shower in Psycho. You know, there was a debate over that for a couple of decades. And then she actually was able to prove it with such ease. I mean, literally, my jaw hit the floor once. She really did do it. Holy crap, we got to have her at the show. This will be awesome. And I remember a friend of mine saying, I don't know how many people are going to want to come meet the woman who got stabbed in the shower in Psycho. And I said, I think a lot of people would, but we got to have one novelty every year, someone you don't normally see at other shows. And I'll be darned if she wasn't busy, and it turned out she had only done 4 shows before, and she did more in autograph sales and meeting with fans on the first day alone than she had combined all the other conventions combined. She was blown away that people actually wanted to meet her. So this year, our novelty is Ellie Woodwalker, and she was like Biker Chick number 4 and Easy Rider and a few other films, but her big claim to fame is having done the 5-minute unaired TV pilot for Wonder Woman. And when Bill Dozier's 1966 Batman show became a big success, he decided to try a bunch of these pilots. He did Dick Tracy and so on and so forth. And for Wonder Woman, he didn't want to spend a lot of money on it. He said, let's do 5 minutes. And if this pilot doesn't sell it to the network, there's no point in spending 25 minutes making a pilot. So she technically, officially, is the first screen Wonder Woman, even if it never aired. She is the first woman to be in a costume dressed as Wonder Woman and play the role before the cameras. And she has never done a convention before. This is all new to her. And I assured her a month or so ago on the phone, I said, trust me, they're coming in from Belgium, England, Australia, Switzerland. I said, they're coming to meet you. You are going to be impressed with how many people want to meet the first screen Wonder Woman. But I will say, being her first show, she doesn't have any photos. So we've been trying to get some photos or screen capture from her as Wonder Woman. I told her friend Scott, I said, look, we only need 2 photos. To be fair, we really don't need a zillion photos. I get she did Targets. I get she did Easy Rider. But you don't need more than 1 photo of her as a hippie chick or a biker girl from Easy Rider. You don't need 4 or 5 photos. 1 is enough. I said, but I'd have a couple Wonder Woman photos just in case. I think we have 1 with a yellow border that he designed or a friend designed, and that should be a really nice one to be able to frame and hang. And I always say, if you're going to frame and hang a celebrity autograph photos on, hang them on the wall, you want to have one that at least has some discussion of who is that? And, oh, you didn't know. And you fill in some little trivia detail so you learn something new. So she's our novelty of the year this year.
Oh, I know. I was talking to friends of mine that are big DC Comics fans, and I said, oh yeah, they're gonna have the first screen Wonder Woman there, and of course they're throwing out the usual names, and I'm like, no, I said this one was in an unaired pilot, and they had no idea. When I told them, they're like, you're kidding. And so that's the fun part. Is I love it when you have the wild card guest, I like to call it, and Marley Renfro was wonderful, and you've had different people over the years, and it's just like I find you one time, I think you had a burlesque dancer, and it was just, it's just great hearing these backstories from them in the Q&As or talking to them at their table.
That's the Storm was a major burlesque stripper in the 50s and 60s, and huge name, actually, like Blaze Starr and Betty Page and all, became a cult status. And there were people who came just because of her. And it's funny, you get those novelties, like, say, Marley Renfro and Tempest Storm. There will be somebody, just like for Ellie Woodwalker, who will show up, will come up to me because they don't know I run it. I'm just wearing a staff shirt. And they'll say, hey, I'm here. I just flew in from Texas. I'm only here for a day. I only got 3 hours. Got to get back to the airport. Save me some time. Where is Ellie Woodwalker? And I'll be sitting there saying, going, yep, there's another novelty that someone came just because of her. And that's what happens every year. We get one of those. And so I'm sure we'll have another one like that. You know, someone will be looking around to find her so they can get her autograph, and probably brought stuff of their own to get merchant signed by her.
It's the fun part, is it's just going and finding out. I know we're not mentioning everybody's name that's coming, because you have, it's a long list. But since we are heading into a James Bond movie discussion in just a minute, who do you have coming from the Bond franchise?
Well, we usually have one or two Bond girls. Two is not intentional. It just always falls into play. We have Mary Staven. She actually did two or three Bond films. They were all Roger Moore. She's known as being, I forget which of the ones, the one where they have the floating bed and the little, it might be For Your Eyes Only or Spy Who Loved Me.
Oh, was it Octopussy?
She was in Octopussy, but she was in another one.
A View to a Kill.
View to a Kill, yes. And she's in the little, she's in the scene where he's lying there in bed with her. So she gets to be a two-time Bond girl. But she also did Octopussy. It's Mary Staven. And then I know we got Christina Weyborn, who was a major Bond girl in Octopussy. She was I always say the formula had two Bond girls. You had a good one and a bad one. The bad one worked with the villain. The good one always ended up, working alongside Bond or not realizing that being victimized or they're after somebody. And, of course, Maude Adams was the good girl in Octopussy, but Christina Weyborn was the lead villainous girl in that one. So we have Christina Weyborn and Mary Staven. And being that it is the 40th anniversary of Octopussy, we're going to screen the movie, too. We'll have Mary Staven and Christina Weyborn up on stage for a half hour or so before the movie so they can talk about the movie, being in the Bond films, and some of their film career as well. So it kind of adds a little bit of fun to get a little background behind the scenes, how the movie was made, et cetera, before you actually see the movie. And you actually get to see the Bond girl. You know, you get to see them in the scene, so they'll talk about, oh, there was this one scene you had to do, yeah. And then you watch the movie, and you actually get a little deeper appreciation. You never watch the same movie. You never watch the movie the same way twice afterwards.
And that's what I find fun, is like, especially if you have the Q&A right before the movie, like you said. So when you're watching it right after that, you're like looking for those scenes. And then the good part is, later in the convention, after you've squatched the movie and seen everything and talked, you can go to their table and you can flesh out what they brought up, you know, because it'll be fresh in your mind watching the movie.
Yep, and it's always adds to the fun of it. It's not so much a recipe or a formula. It's just there's a large number of people who actually, I think there's about 300 or so people who come year after year because we have a Bond girl, and they collect their Bond girl autographs, so they have their collection, and they like to add one or two, and they find that they don't want to spend untold sums of money getting, 50 Bond girls in one calendar year when they can go meet the stars in person routinely and religiously every year. So for them, it's kind of fun to be able to meet them. So those are the two we have this year. That should be fun. Christina seems to be a hoot, so I think people are going to really love meeting her.
I'm looking forward to it, and before we switch over to the movie, any other celebrities you want to talk about or bring to people's attention before we switch over?
Well, the celebs change because, based on scheduling, and now you get that pending actor strike, which could change things, which is actually for us the benefit, not so much for the stars. Because all of a sudden they're now available where they weren't available before. So things change. I always tell people, check the website, and we can give the website address. This year's dates is September 7, 8, and 9. Usually it's in the middle of September. I forget why the hotel could only give us the weekend before. So it's September 7, 8, and 9 in Hunt Valley, Maryland. It's at the Hunt Valley Delta Marriott, where they hold a lot of conventions, so most people are in the area are familiar with it. The website is www.midatlanticnostalgiaconvention.com. It's the name of the event, MidAtlanticNostalgiaConvention.com. And my suggestion, check the website religiously. I know some people who check it literally once a month just to see who's coming and go, oh, look who they added, or, oh, so I guess she's not going to be able to make it now, but look who they got in their place, because, you know, anything can change schedule-wise with stars. And even up to the last minute, somebody could be added to the, you know, it could happen, or somebody ends up canceling. They could get sick or be in the hospital. Anything can happen. But I always say check the website, but that's the best way.
And also, you have a mailing list, and that way when there's somebody added on, you can get the, you'll get an email saying, this person, that's how I found out about Haley Mills, because it's not on the website yet, but I got the email. And yeah, Juliet Mills and Maxwell Caulfield is like, oh, recently added, coming. And I was like, yes!
Yeah, and we always tell people that Facebook and the email is a week behind the website, and it's done deliberately. And it's literally to tell people and encourage them, please sign up, because you want to be among the first. And we wouldn't say you'd be among the first if you couldn't go to the website and find out yourself. So we do that on purpose a lot of times. So people can go up there and go, oh, wow, look who's coming. This is going to be really nice. And whether the stars are big names or small names, I know some people, they frame them, they hang them up on the wall, and progressively over the years, they've built a shrine, or they've gone around one corner of their room and they're now on another wall. But it's, and sometimes they get their photos taken with celebs, and then they'll print them out and put them up there. But it's kind of like a collection of autographs, and it's memories. It's a lot like their own scrapbook with their family photos. It's memories to look back at, and it's a great conversation starter for people at the house to say, oh, yeah, I met this Bond girl. And they'll go, who's that? And tell them, like, oh, my goodness, that is them. Wow, look at that. So I've always told people it's worth going to check out, even just to meet the star. The one advantage is, they don't even have to get autographs or get their photos taken if they don't want to. They can sit in on the Q&A and just listen to the stories that the celebs tell up on stage. So, you know, we've had some agents who in the past have said you should be charging for an extra admission fee to sit on the Q&As. And I was like, no, we're not doing that. We're running it for the fans. So they can come and have fun and barely spend a penny and enjoy the weekend and get, you know, the magazine, full color magazine program guide. They get to go home as a souvenir. I know some people get them signed over the weekend, so that way they've got, you know, each year they've got all the signatures on of all the stars that showed up, and that's what some people actually collect. So everyone's each to their own.
And also, you can go to the celebs' tables and talk to them. It doesn't cost anything. So there's lots of ways you can interact with that. I mean, it doesn't cost anything in addition to the admission to get into the convention, which is not that much. How much does it cost for tickets for a day and for the weekend?
It's $25 a day per person. The only discount is if they're getting the whole weekend, which is $60, and that's if they do it online. It used to be $20, but the prices and cost of running convention this year, first time in, I think, 14 years, we had to raise the price, which is not bad, $25 a day for access to everything. And the primary reason is most shows, even held up the same weekend, the cheapest price on the cheapest day is like $35 or $40. So we figure we've given people a good discount, plus a full-color program magazine that they get to go home with, some cool articles, write-ups about the celebs that are there that weekend. And like I said, they can sit in on the Q&As, watch some of the seminars, wander the vendor room. Vendors are not interested just solely in selling. Sometimes they're interested in buying. People will bring their collectibles and go around from vendor to vendor and see if any of them are interested. And once in a while, vendors are like, ooh, yeah, I'll take that off your hands. How much you want for it? Because, you know, they know a customer of theirs at the next show might be interested in buying it, so they'll buy it from you. And you can even find out, say, look, I'm not interested in selling it. I just want to know what the value is under this condition. So it's a learning experience, too. So I always say you don't have to be there just to buy. You just go there and have a grand time. But it's amazing how that old lunchbox you used to have when you went to school every day might be worth $150 today.
That is true. And one thing I want to ask you is Brendan Faulkner going to be a vendor this year again?
Yes, he is. Yep.
One thing I want people to know, he's the hidden celebrity that's there year after year. You know, I have an interview of him that's going to be coming out so people can listen to everything that Brendan Faulkner has done. And it's a lengthy interview. It's about 2 hour long, but he's been in movies like the original Dawn of the Dead. He's done movies like Spookies and things like that, but the hidden celebrity.
Yeah, there's always a lot of there's always a lot of people who are attendees or vendors and so on who actually had a little bit of a Hollywood career, but you know, it was a little career, so they don't really mention it. I know one guy who shows up as an attendee every year. He was actually a dancer in Hello, Dolly! And a couple other movies at MGM and 20th Century Fox. In fact, I remember watching an episode of the 1970s variety show, Julie Andrews Show, and I look in the back and I go, oh, there's Herb. Look at that. You know, so but he's an attendee every year. He never tells anybody, but if people know who he is, they can go up there and he'll pose for a photo with them and so on. So, and I think we've had a couple celebrities who quietly and very quietly came into the show just to meet a certain celebrity that, you know, I was a kid when I worked with them. I didn't realize who I was working with. I was too young and loved to meet them quietly. So it's amazing who's wandering around. But yeah, Brendan's one of those vendors. He's got stories to tell and great stories.
Oh, they are. And listeners, you can listen to the interview with him and that kind of stuff and hear those stories. He's a great storyteller. And look at the stuff he has at his tables. So he has a lot of wonderful stuff there too.
Yeah, nice guy. A really nice guy.
But now, the other reason people are listening to this episode is not because just the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, but on Her Majesty's Secret Service. I asked, with Martin, I didn't roll the dice. Normally I roll dice with people to decide the genre. That's why it's called Diecast Movie Podcast. You roll a die to pick the genre. But when I have like Ron Adams from Monster Bash or Martin on to talk about their conventions, I usually let them pick the movie. And you picked On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And why did you pick this wonderful movie?
Well, I picked that movie because that's one of my favorite Bond films. I clearly say it's one of the five best Bond films. And it covers pretty much all the aspects you want in a spy movie without going over the top. And the Bond franchise has a history of going up and down in certain directions. So I always say each Bond movie is different than the other. To me, that one is close to perfection for what a Bond film should be. And so I figured, you know, that one is worth taking some time to talk about and look at and revisit.
I'm glad you did, because the last time I saw On Her Majesty's Secret Service was possibly 40 years ago, 35 to 40 years ago. So I was a teenager, and I think, for me, being that young, and there are certain movies I really was drawn to, but it didn't hit me the way it hit me when I watched it again before we talked about this. And my appreciation for the movie significantly went higher. I mean, it was just because I just remember being like, yeah, it was a movie. You know, it was a Bond movie. But on this rewatch, I really enjoyed the movie. And I'm really glad you picked it for me to watch.
Good. Yeah, it's as you know, the Bond film started a secret agent craze. So in the 60s, there was a ton of those secret agent movies. And sometimes they pull regular detectives that had no longer been in movies and said, well, we're just going to take like Bulldog Drummond and make him a secret agent for a couple movies. And so when you watch enough of them, you start seeing which ones are good ones, which ones are bad ones, which ones are cheaply made. You could tell what they were all trying to cash in on the spy craze of the 60s. And it's funny how some would be a little bit more grounded, others would be more science fictionish. You watch Dimension 5 with Jeffrey Hunter and you see that they're dealing with time travel and a secret agent. You're like, okay, that's different. And it's interesting because the On Her Majesty's Secret Service comes in on a tail end of where somebody had told George Lazenby, and they were correct. Look, Easy Rider made big money in the theaters. Right now, that's going to be the next big craze, and which he was right. And he said the spy films are passe. They're going to drop dead. And within the next year or two, there's not going to be any of these spy movies. Everyone's going to try to cash in on Easy Rider, which he was right again. And so basically, this movie was filmed throughout, you know, late 30s, 68, all of a big chunk of 1969, came out in December 69 around Christmas. So it really was launching in the 1970s. So it was a different type of Bond. And the movie does a few things that you don't see in prior Bond films. Plus, they have a different actor playing Bond. And I think people are best associating with Sean Connery. And so it had a bit of a stigma because it's not Sean Connery. And they did differences. But as a connoisseur for Bond films, I will say, to me, it's one of the top five. And as a connoisseur, George Lazenby is not a bad Bond. Like any new person who comes in, like Daniel Craig, you got to give him more than a couple movies or at least more than a watch just to get an idea of who's Bond. And I think at this point, they've broken the mold where there's an image to upheld, but there's not a big image that you have to maintain. The hair could be a different color. You can have a blonde Bond. It doesn't matter as long as it goes for what they're shooting for. And for me, this movie really is probably one of the best spy movies, not just one of the best Bond movies ever made.
To me, it's one of the best dramatic Bond movies, you know, because there are action scenes, but the drama in the relationships between George Lazenby and Diana Rigg, who played the Countess Tracy, you just really love that relationship. I mean, Diana Rigg, I mean, just, you're talking about somebody who was at the top of her game. I don't think she was ever off the top of her game for either career, but I mean, here she was after the Avengers or during the Avengers run, she goes right into the starring role with George Lazenby. And it's just the way she portrays it and the humor and the stuff like that she puts to it and the pathos as the movie goes on. And listeners, we're probably going to end up spoiling the movie, but I think most people have probably seen this movie. But if you haven't seen it, go see it.
Yeah, and we're going to end up having to give away the ending anyway. We figured if they're listening to this, they've already seen it before watching, listening to the conversation. And to be fair, it's not, while it's not a spoiler, it's not that big of a spoiler, but it's very significant in the movie. I approach it from not just the perspective of all the Bond films made and what would be the best of them, basically all spy films in general. I think it's one of the best done. It's amazing because they just broke the mold in that last Daniel Craig movie where Bond dies. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, at that time, you know, there's a few rules they rarely break. And then yet you look back at what makes this unique, what makes that unique. If the hero dies at the end of the novels or stories, which rarely happens, that's a good thing because you want that, but there has to be a point and purpose, not just a death. And in this case, while he doesn't die, his wife gets killed. And the relationship between he and her is meant to be that way in the movie. So at the end, you feel sorry for him. And I think the audience was more in shock than sympathy, which was part of the problem. People didn't expect that ending. And yet, I equate that to almost like the death of Bond, the hero in itself. And like, you got to have a death at the end, else, you know, you can't be immortal. And one of my favorite pop cultures is The Lone Ranger. And there are episodes, like I listened to one of the radio shows the other day. He gets beaten, shot from a distance, beaten, and by the villains. And then he has to recover. And it takes him 3 weeks to recover before he can go incognito and go arrest the villain, help apprehend the villains. And I thought to myself, this is great. He's not superhuman. He's not Superman. And in this case, Bond is not Superman.
Definitely. And one of the things I wish, of course, you already brought up why he didn't want to, he only wanted to do the one movie because his agent recommended it. They wanted to sign him to a 7-year deal. You know, it'd been interesting in some multiverse. He did sign the deal, and who knows what those movies would have been. We'll never know. We don't live in that multi-universe. But it was, to see the end the way it was, I think this is like the James Bond version of like Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, where you have the villains, in a sense, win in the end, and how does the side of the good guys recover?
Right, and in this sense, the villain wins and gets away, speeds away, and the hero, while it was meant for him, he doesn't die, but the wife dies. It, to me, is almost the equivalent of the hero being killed because he actually had a purpose for continuing to live. If you remember in the movie, Tracy actually was going to commit suicide. He saves her. So in this case, he gave her a purpose, then she gave him a purpose. And now without her, his life is meaningless, which, of course, in the next movie, he's literally going after Blofeld. I mean, literally, he doesn't care. He's got a license to kill. He's going after him. And it became personal. And so, and a couple of references, someone would say, like, I think in one of the Pierce Brosnan films, because they are meant to maintain continuity, is there a Mrs. Bond in your life? And he would just dismiss it like he didn't want to talk about it. And so in this case, it's an unusual film because he's given a deal. And take care of my daughter, treat her well, you know, and in return, I'll give you the info you want. And so he unscrupulously is spending time, in a sense, courting her, in which he has no interest in her. He just wants Blofeld. And then progressively towards the end of the film, he has become a changed man. They always say a wife doesn't give you you gain a wife, you gain a family, you get a home, you give her a home, she gives you, you buy her a house, she gives you a home. And in this case, he got grounded and then he lost that footing. So that's one of the many reasons why, story wise, I love the film. But the cinematography is also, and you have to admit, is fantastic.
Oh.
And that's the one thing that James Bond films had that most of the other spy films of the 60s never had, was that very expensive cinematography. And it's not so much expensive, it's expensive because if you want to get that right shot, it could take 2 weeks up in the Swiss Alps. So now it's costing you every day to not have the shot. And even with the Bond, Broccoli himself, the producer, said there were times where he literally told them, guys, it's been 2.5 weeks. You don't get the shot by tomorrow. We'll pack it up. We'll call it a wash. And then that last day, they got lucky and got the shot. And then he said, it's worth every penny. They've always had the best cinematography in those movies. So in fact, I'm surprised they never won as many Oscars as they should have for those films. But in that movie, I think cinematography is among the best.
Yeah, Michael Reed did a beautiful job getting those shots. And it was just, especially because you're talking with the skiing aspect, you really felt you were getting that sense of you're going with them, you know, and going down the hill and the vistas when they're showing the mountains and everything. It's just really puts you in there.
Film it, and they filmed it in Switzerland. In fact, I think that was a commissary restaurant that was never fully completed, if I remember correctly. It was also used as a forest ranger lookout of sorts. And so they talked to the country and said, we'll fund the $60,000 to ship all the concrete up there to get it finished. In return, we get to film it up there. And they had no problem with it, and that was the arrangement. But they realized they had such scenic views. It was also cheaper because up until that time in the Bond films, they were recycling a lot of the sets. So they were starting to repaint the walls. But if you know with certain architecture, especially if it's made of cement, you know, I always joke the MGM backlot, because you can always tell because the cement pillars in front of the doorways never change. Once you know it, it's too late. You can't unsee it. They kept recycling a lot of the sets, and it was costing a little bit of money for renovation. And here they thought we could get better scenic views, better landscapes and different scenery, so we're not recycling it, so it won't feel like the same movie. Almost like a TV show where they're recycling the same office and living room set over and over, episode after episode.
Oh, yes. And Peter Hunt directing it, because when I give credit to the cinematography, I always like to give credit to the director too, because you never know how much each one is involved with going for certain shot selection. And so I always like to give credit to both. But I felt this is the most, like I said, dramatic, also the most, one of the most grounded Bond movies. And it's just you really feel it lets the characters develop. And I like movies where you felt you really get a chance to know more about some certain characters and really get to understand them. So when something happens to them, you feel it even more.
Correct. And I've always believed part of the process of making this movie more grounded is I've read almost all the Ian Fleming novels, and I will tell you, there are two novels worth reading. One is Casino Royale, fantastic prose, one of the 10 best books I ever read. Incidentally, the prose is not the same on any of the other Fleming novels. My honest opinion is and belief is that he actually took the novel, it got rejected by a publisher, he tweaked it, it got polished, he sent it to another publisher, 30 publishers later they take it, by then it's been tweaked and polished to a perfection. The prose is magnificent. After Casino Royale, and that was the first Bond novel, after that, the prose is almost like he writes like hack, and I don't mean to knock Ian Fleming, but the prose is different. And if you're okay with that prose, and I like really good prose, I'm not saying they're hard reads, but I would read them as slower, take my time, like might take a month to read a novel, but it's reading it on and off because I just can't sit there, relish every word of the printed page. But the other novel I recommend is Moonraker, because Moonraker is the only novel that was not done to a T in the movies per se, but there are so many elements from Moonraker that were borrowed and used and recycled for so many Bond movies that by the time they got to Moonraker, they had used up all that and they couldn't possibly use it, or it would have been a rehash of every movie they made, which is why they chose the story that they did for the cinematic Moonraker. Anyway, they borrowed the story elements. They always said they wanted to be faithful, and they never kind of were. But I would say On Her Majesty's Secret Service is the only one that is almost page by page to the movie. And I don't know if they did that deliberately and wanted to, or it was just the story was that good and whoever did the transferred it to a screenplay literally understood the story and said, we're going to go by scene, and we're just going to make this movie straight from the novel.
I haven't read the book, so I really can't, comment on that, but I can just tell it was done. The screenplay obviously lifted a lot from the story, from the book and from what you're saying. And so the translation or whatever, making into that was very well done.
Yeah. What also makes it more grounded is the fact that he uses very little gadgets, if any. In most of the prior ones, they were going more science fiction. So he'd have all these different gadgets. And here, they minimized the gadgets. He was also, George Lazenby had never been much of an actor. He was a model before that. So Lazenby was not capable of, he knew his marks when he's on a camera, but he would never go off mark. But he was not good at standing there and just answering and having a dialogue in front of a camera as good as he could have or should have at the time. Mainly because he just never had all those years of stage training leading up to a movie or TV at roles. So the director, Peter Hunt, said, well, why don't we just make sure that the screenplay has a lot more action? So therefore, there's a lot more action with George Lazenby and a lot less talk, because we can work with that and then we can work him into an actor progressively through the film. And so that's what they did. And as a result, it comes off more grounded because, I wouldn't say because of the action scenes, it's just a different type of Bond versus you watch Sean Connery and he's doing suave moves, and here they're like, we can't have him do the suave moves. All we can do is have him do something like grab a Playboy magazine and go into the other room, something that you don't normally expect it, but it's the new Bond of the 70s that's going to ring in, so let's try it this method. And it works tremendously well for what they wanted to pull off is suave Bond doing how he wants to do it, what he wants to do, but it's not all science fiction and gadgets.
Yep, and it also explains why sometimes they're using a montage when developing the relationship, because that way it's easier for him as a model, like they're doing a commercial. Okay, you're looking like this, look like you're in love, and all those things, and he doesn't have to worry about conveying that through words as well. So I think that probably helped him out a lot.
Yeah, I remember when George Lazenby was at our convention and he and I had a brief talk, and normally I don't talk about movies. I talk about anything other than movies and stars. But he was one of the few. And I remember him saying that when they first got him, and he had never signed the contract, he signed a letter of intent. And so he was filming months on end without an actual contract, which was pissing them off. And they were like, you got to sign a contract, dude. We're filming, we're putting money into it. A letter of intent covered them, but he still got to sign a contract, else they're stuck with just that one movie. Anyway, as they kept filming it, he was telling me how they, once they first got him to sign a letter of intent, they said, don't be surprised if some of your ads disappear in the magazine. So what do you mean ads? They go, well, we can't have James Bond promoting deodorant. We're contacting those companies and buying the ad space that they had already paid for so that we won't be seeing you when the movie comes out in magazines trying to hawk whatever suit you're wearing, whatever deodorant you're pushing off, because he was a model. So it cost them so much money just to have him, even though he was not yet actually signed and being paid a salary per se just to be on the movie.
Well, that's something I never thought about, the image and everything like that. It's just, I learned something new.
Yeah. And it was funny. George wrote an unpublished, it's still unpublished, an autobiography. And he gave it to his agent, who gave it to me and said, read it. Let me know what you think of it. And I gave her my opinion and so on. And I won't go into there because I don't want to make anybody, whatever. Anyway, I talked to the agent, and she says, well, I'm pissing him off because I'm telling him he's wrong. what do you mean he's wrong? She goes, well, he said he's on the cover of this magazine. And I took a look at that month and year, and I bought a copy of it. He's not on the cover. And I said, you do know the British issue had a different cover than the American issue. And she'd go, oh. And I said, no, I trust me. He's right on all this stuff in the book. He is dead on accurate. Don't keep pissing him off. Well, the book never got published, and I have no idea what the arrangement was. Heck, I'd publish it for him if I wanted to, but I do a few tweaks to it. To be fair, most people want to read more about Bond than his modeling career. So, there's not enough Bond is basically my overall opinion in the book, but you can only talk about so much of it, too. But it doesn't have to be a thick book, either. Anyway, I remember him telling me about the modeling part and saying they had to buy my ads, they had to contact those companies. There was so much there, yet it's funny. Diana Rigg got paid, I think it was £70,000 to be in the movie. It was like a flat fee. But keeping in mind that she made that much, I think, in the two or three or four years that they were doing the Avengers in color, not even the black and whites with her, because when they went color, she said, I need my contract renewed, and they gave her a different, more money because they realized she's the reason they were watching, the people were tuning into the Avengers. She was paid more than George Lazenby for the movie. He found out later on. And the end result is, had he taken the contract, he would have received a ton of money. But the reason they wanted to pay him so little is primarily because they said, look, we got to put so much money into trying to curb your image and create an image for you publicly since you're a model. So it kind of makes sense where someone might say they were short-shafting him on the financials. But in reality, no, they weren't. And it just cost more to have him there than Sean Connery. And then irony later, they hired Connery for like $1.25 million. And he got a percentage of the gross sales on top of just to do one more Bond knob movie. And I'm thinking, so which one was more expensive, paying for those magazine ads for deodorant with George Lazenby, or paying for Connery and offering him a percentage of the gross?
Does make you wonder, and as we all know of Hollywood, you never get to see the books, the true books.
True. And I think when they offered Connery 12.5% of the gross, which was unheard of and ridiculous for that last Bond novel movie, when he came back to do the one more movie, I truly believe they didn't expect the money to be that big for him anyway, because the amount of money for each Bond movie after Thunderball started dropping. And the amount of money they made on Her Majesty's Secret Service was 50% of the amount of money they made the movie prior with Connery. So I think they were curious, saying, look, if it's a downward trend, he's only getting a percentage of the box office gross. You know, what are we losing? 12.5% of what? So let's say the movie makes nothing. He gets 12.5% of nothing. So from a business end, I get why they made that offer. But if the movie had done tremendously successful, and I think it did decently well, I'd be sitting back saying, well, you know, that was a bad decision, guys. We just lost a lot of money that we could have had in our pockets. Of course, they did want Roger Moore before George Lazenby, but he was unavailable because he had just finished or was finishing The Saint, and they felt he was too closely associated with The Saint at the time. But more importantly, they really wanted his entry to be Live and Let Die. And they couldn't film in a certain country they wanted to because there was something going on, and they said it's not safe. And that's the only reason, else they probably would have progressed forward and said, let's just have Roger Moore do Live and Let Die, and let's try that one. So, you know, two movies later, they did get Roger Moore to do the role that they wanted him to do.
It's amazing how certain things work out in certain ways. If you look at the history of different Bond actors, where they wanted them earlier, but they didn't get them, and eventually they got them later. It's kind of very ironic or coincidental how things happen or meant to happen.
Yeah, and for George Lazenby, it's not a bad thing. He goes to conventions, he signs autographs. He's still making money being Bond and signing photos of Bond and collector cards of Bond, Bond merchandise. So in reality, I don't know what royalties he's still getting, because under standards, they are getting some royalties progressively. I think even Sean Connery, up to the day he died, was still getting, and maybe his estate is still getting, royalties for the Bond movies. So every time one of those titles, you know, and ends up, let's say now that it's under Amazon ownership, every time you stream one of those Sean Connery films, is his estate still getting a few more pennies on top of? So I think George Lazenby's still making some royalties off it, but just on top of that, he's making $20, $30 signing his name on all these for glossy photo and collector cards and all progressively. So it's like the old joke, if you can be in the right superhero movie and you do two or three superhero movies, you're set for life. You can just go around signing autographs for the next 20 years and make good big buku bucks.
Yeah, it's a way of looking at it. It's like, oh, I got my side retirement fund, so to speak.
Yep. I know United Artists, who was the distributor at the time, was not in favor of George Lazenby. They preferred Connery, and so we'd strike a deal with Connery, and that's what happened afterwards. But they were not in size of George Lazenby. But from all publicity and advertising and the trailers and stuff, United Artists did not skimp and say, well, let's just hurt the movie deliberately, just to, you know, kind of see if we can get back to Connery. They wanted to make money off the film as well. So they put their good faith effort like Broccoli and said, let's go for this. But from a standpoint of a story that's supposed to be spy, more grounded, less science fiction, and an ending that technically makes him a bit more of a hero and a bit more warmth, I think if he had stayed on another two or three or four movies, he would have become just as iconic as Roger Moore and Sean Connery. But more importantly, I'm wondering if Roger Moore ever would have became Bond as a result, because the timeline would have changed.
That's what I said. If only we had access to that alternate universe where it happened, but we'll never know which way it would have went. Now, Telly Savalas as Blofeld. What did you think about it? Because he replaced Donald Pleasance, if I remember right.
Correct. Yeah, Pleasance was the first. He was in the first movie. Blofeld was in prior. They just never had any face shown, because until Bond actually meets Blofeld in person, they didn't feel that there was a point of having a face. And you had to have a quote-unquote arch nemesis, especially if, like the old Pulp Seal days, the arch nemesis is never the one committing the crimes. They are pulling the strings and sending people off to do whatever needs to be done to do the job, dirty job. In other words, he's the mastermind behind the scenes. So when Sean Connery in the film prior, Bond, manages to finally catch up to Blofeld, he finally gets to meet him, and they face-to-face, they brought in Donald Pleasance. I think they should have kept Donald Pleasance. But Pleasance always considered himself more of a Shakespearean actor and hated doing anything, including Halloween, and then later looking back saying it wasn't a bad gig. But at the times, he always wanted something a bit more, less colorful and a bit more dramatic. And so they got Telly Savalas. And I think they went through one or two other people before they got Telly Savalas to come in and play the role. And I believe there's a reference that he just had to say, they said something about it. What a great surgery you did. Your ears are different. And they trim the ears because that's one of the few things you can't actually change on a human being when you do facial reconstructions in most cases. Well, they always say that's how you identify people in photos, depending on the age of the ears. And so they made reference. And there was, I think, in the first draft, the very first draft of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, that that Bond himself was going to go through surgery, hence why his face looks different. And the intent was to make reference to he's been known by so many of his enemies, so now I have to change his face and look at him. And then they did the same thing for Blofeld, but then they decided to keep it as Blofeld and just be tongue-in-cheek humor regarding this wouldn't have happened to the other fellow.
I love that line when he says that in the opening scene when George Lazenby goes, this wouldn't have happened to the other fellow, you know, which is, of course, kind of his tagline. Even to today, you know, he's selling shirts and everything with it.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting. In the beginning, in that opening scene, they don't want you to look like Connery, so they do him more in the shadows. You actually don't see the face till it gets more right to the end of that opening scene where there's a close-up. In other words, you could tell the director actually made this movie with some intent and purpose and some style and flair, and it works beautifully. In fact, even All the Time in the World with Louis Armstrong was a fantastic song, and it's not remnants to what you would have heard in prior Bond movies, and not remnants to most of the Bond movies later when they would have a type of song that even today my wife and I would hear a song and go, my God, that'd be a great Bond song. You know, it's just not what you expect from a Louis Armstrong and John Barry score, but it's one of Barry's best scores for any Bond movie, and that's a great song that works for the movie, because it says we're not doing the same type of spy movies you're familiar with. We're going a different direction.
Yes, yes. And there are some things I loved how the director utilize some of the character players. Countess Tracy had these guys that were like her bodyguard. Her father had the bodyguard that was with her. And which at first you think they're trying to kill her or kill Bond or whatever. You don't know who they are, but eventually you find out they're actually, I guess, there to protect her from herself or from whatever. And so these guys always were fighting James Bond. They're always in fisticuffs throughout the beginning of the movie. And then, of course, they disappear in the middle, like when it gets to the Blofeld part, until the wedding scene. And I loved when Peter Hunt had the camera cut to those guys when they got married, and everybody else is clapping real and they're doing that polite little golf clap, all four of them. And I just loved it. I was just like, oh, that is so perfect.
Yeah, and it was kind of a transition that they're handing over. He's capable of taking care of her. Her job's done, but we're not going to be out of a job. We'll be doing something else. But you can tell the way they shot the scene that that's how they were writing them out so they wouldn't be moving forward.
And also, Moneypenny, Lois Maxwell, where I felt, even though Moneypenny's only ever in like just a little bit of each Bond film, I felt this one, you know, because she's always pining for Bond, and it just had that nice parts where she acted so well during it.
Yeah, and I think she tosses a hat to her, sort of like the old tradition of a bouquet, that traditionally she's the next to get married. In the books, she's actually his cousin.
Oh, really?
I didn't know if you knew that. Moneypenny was always his cousin. So there was always that little romantic verbal play between the two, but it was only on a professional level. In the movies, as the years progressed, they would take Lois Maxwell's character and always have that double entendre line back and forth between the two, like she's the only woman he couldn't get. But in the books, it's because she's his cousin. And then, of course, I think one of the Pierce Brosnans, they had replaced Lois Maxwell with another actress who played Moneypenny, and then they kind of started hinting more of a romantic relationship between the two. And I always thought it was more funny when it was verbal foreplay, but nothing else. You know, is that, you know, he doesn't get all the girls.
I agree with you. You know, you got to have that one that's always the impossible reach, the impossible dream type girl.
Yeah, and Lois Maxwell, I remember in an interview, was asked about George Lazenby, and she said, to be fair, it's not his fault. He was not an actor. He was a model. They said, we're just going to, and it's happened in Hollywood before, like, say, Quentin Spilsbury for Legend of the Lone Ranger. They said, you know what? He looks the part. We'll make it work. We'll make it work. You know, we can pull off enough scenes. We can make it work. And the reality was, as she says, to be fair, George was a nice man in person. He could not act. She says we could all tell. But it's just because he was never trained. It's not something you can be born with. It's not a gift. It's a talent you have to be aspire to, and then you have to progress your way up. She goes, it's a lot like needlework. It's not something you can do perfectly on the first day. She says, but the one thing she remembered about him on the set was that he was always skirt chasing the actor. She says, and it was amazing how there was always a different woman or hanging around him every time she turned around. And she says, I don't know if women just were like, hey, he's going to be the next James Bond, and he's going to be like the next wealthy Sean Connery or the next big name, or he was just that much of a charmer. She says, but she says, I swear I've never seen a person have a different woman on his shoulder or on his elbow, hanging on his elbow every time she turned around the entire 9 months they were filming.
Well, maybe he was a method actor.
Well, personally, he makes no qualms. He publicly talks about, yeah, I was always hitting on girls. I was always smoozing around with them, and he makes no qualm about it. He's like, life was short, and I was living it up and enjoying it. He said his only big regret was not signing the contract. They even offered money just to get him to sign the freaking contract. And he listened to the wrong advice. He said, spy films are passe. You're going to become a joke, and then you're going to be stuck in this role. You don't sign. Just hold out for a little bit more. And the money came around. He said, when they offered money just to get him to sign, like for you, just for signing, we're giving you this check. He said he knew at that time he should have signed, and he walked out of the office and said, you know what? I keep being told there's going to be a better offer. I'm wondering if that's as good as it gets. And he said he held on out too long. He said it really, they would have kept him for movie after movie after movie if they could. They would have had him for seven movies and probably taken advantage of all seven films. So looking back now, he says he should have taken it. But he says, life is what it is. He's still technically Bond, even if it's just one movie.
That is true. That is true. And I will give him credit. The end scene where his reaction is, you know, of course, they're hiding his face, you know, because he's got his face down, and the Countess is, you know, holding her head. So it's shielding him from showing facial expressions. But the words that they had come out, and he did a good job of delivering them, you know, when he's going through the shock of realizing that she's dead. And that, you know, when he's saying, oh, she's just resting. She just needs a moment. And he knows she's gone, but he just doesn't want to believe it. You know, that really gets to you.
Yeah, and I remember Lazenby told me they filmed it twice. They said the first time they shot it, he had tears down his cheeks. He was crying. He said that he was very pleased that on the first take, he was able to muster those tears. He said, I remember being proud of myself, saying, I don't know how actors are able to call out tears or not, but here on my first shot, I'm crying out tears. I don't need them to blow that crap in my eyes and make it cry. And he said, as soon as they were done, there was a pause. And then the director said, let's do it with a bit more restrained performance. Let's try it without the tears and so on. And he said they took the version without the tears. He goes, that's why his head is down, is because he still had all that water-sogged eyes from the first take. And he thinks the first take would have been much better. He says, but the restrained performance is what they were looking for. Is he's still Bond. He's got to be a bit masculine towards the very end.
That'd be interesting. I'd have to see the other take to make a proper decision. But, I mean, to see Bond totally lose it, I think would be off character a little bit there, you know, because he's handled so many different things. I think the restrained approach probably was the best choice, but not having seen the other one, it's hard for me to tell.
I would say the restrained is more fun. Someone breaks down and cries in the manner that he was describing. That was how the first shot was taken, and then they said, well, let's try another shot, and then we'll decide which of the two. I agree, the restrained shot probably works best.
I'm not going to argue with you there. What was like one or two of your favorite scenes in the movie that we haven't talked about yet?
The cinematography, I think, is fantastic. The hayride scene and the car chase is great as usual. Notice the car doesn't have gadgets this time. No gadgets, which was done before. There's that bronchitis there I mentioned. I always believe that the skiing scene was done very well. In fact, he liked to ski, and they told him not to ski when they were not filming because they didn't want him to injure himself. And yet he still went out and did skiing, and they were like shaking their heads going, he's not listening to us. If he injures himself, it's going to cost us money. And yet many of those scenes, that actually is him skiing, because he would say, look, if there's any risk to injury, then fine, use a stuntman, but I can do my own scene. So why did you not want to use my own scene? I'm a professional in skiing. And they said, all right. So I think the skiing scenes look a little bit better. It depends. It was when I first saw the film, I was a kid, and I didn't think too heavily of it, I guess because I didn't really take this. It really wasn't the science fiction type Bond I had been familiar with by that time. But over the years, having watched it again a few times, I realized it's one of the best, mainly because overall, it's not like a scene that as a kid threw me for a loop. Remember the one Roger Moore where he jumps over the cliff as he's skiing and out comes the parachute and
yes.
The flag of England. As a kid, that was awesome. But, you know, it's when you're 7 years old and you're watching ABC Thursday night movie or Sunday night movie or whatever, you know, that's an awesome scene. It's something you never lose. For Her Majesty's Secret Service, there's no scene in particular that really is awe-inspiring. This is awesome. You know, it's just visually from beginning to end, a very smooth movie, a very well-made movie. It's a spy film that's not the normal type spy film, but he's still a secret agent. He's still a spy. He still has a license to kill. He's investigating. If anything, Blofeld's scheme to actually let go of a virus to make men sterile or female sterile in the world still doesn't make sense. And I equate it to the old, somewhere in the 80s or 90s, there's a Spider-Man comic in which there's a doomsday bomb invented. And Dr. Octopus, I think it's for the first time they have the Sinister Six. And Dr. Octopus threatens the whole world. He's going to let off the doomsday bomb. And at the end of the one issue, Spider-Man gets knocked unconscious. with a gas bomb from I think Hobgoblin. All of them are surrounding, all six of them are surrounding them. And they're like, push the button, and they push the button. In the beginning of the next issue, they're like, I'm pushing the button. Why is there no explosions? And Doc Ock comes around the building and goes, you idiot. What good is ruling the world if it's dead? Of course there's no doomsday bomb. You actually thought there was a doomsday bomb? You really thought there was a doomsday bomb? And I sit back and I think about that same aspect with the Blofeld here. Really? You're going to let off a virus that's going to make a 99.5% of the world's population sterile? Why? What do you gain out of that? And to me, I don't think there's anything to actually physically be gained from it. And so it kind of defeats the whole point of, I think they could have came up with something a little bit better as a villainous scheme that could have been foiled. But then again, this isn't about the villain and a scheme. In this case, it's about Bond and Tracy.
Yes, definitely is. For me, I think I said a couple of my favorite scenes are like those smaller scenes, like with Money Penny and the crew that was out there to protect Tracy, especially the scene at the end at the wedding where they just kept that through line all the way. For action scenes, I think when they were skiing has to be the top of the parts when they were just going down that hill and you had all those skiers going after them and the different little set pieces they were doing and James Bond going to one ski for crying out loud and continuing on. I mean, it was pretty impressive.
And the film, to be fair, is probably, I would say, like I said, visually it's magnificent. Peter Hunt was a capable director, but in many cases I find the directors get more credit and they get more crap from the films. They're almost like the president of the United States. It doesn't matter who's in office. If anything goes right, they get credit. If everything goes wrong, they get the blame. A director just shows up on the set. Everybody else in movie making does their jobs. Like the cinematographer does his cinematography. The set designer does his set design. The director just shows up on the set, looks it over and says, looks good. Yep. All set. Yep. Okay. So in other words, it's the director's only as good as the capable people that are capable working under them. The only time I've ever seen a director really make a difference in a film, the two things I've noticed is, A, it's the way they can shoot with the camera. In other words, today's filmmakers, they come from an era of videotape, so the camera is always moving. The only people who don't do that, Scorsese, Spielberg, M. Night Shyamalan, Tarantino, Clint Eastwood, the people who literally the cameras will pan to the left or the right slowly or zoom in and out. They don't play with the camera. That kind of direction is clearly the director, not the people working under him, but that's the director who tells them, this is how you're going to film it. And the other difference I've noticed is the acting. You watch a Steven Spielberg movie, it doesn't matter who's in the movie, he can pull a performance out of somebody, and it's always flawless. There's never a bad actor perform. And I'm not saying there wasn't a bad actor at one time, and he decides to fire them and replace them with a different actor or actress. That depends. M. Night Shyamalan can get a performance out of people. Tarantino can. I think he just enjoys making movies. Peter Hunt had the right people working for him, but I somewhat question whether or not how much of an influence he had in the making of this beyond one or two aspects, because he was probably more fixated on trying to make sure George Lazenby looks like Bond and can actually act on the camera. So I sometimes say it's probably the crew in this case more than the director. But if Peter Hunt had done, I've never seen enough of his movies to be able to judge it, but if he had done multiple Bond movies, I probably would be able to sit back and wager or look at it and see whether or not it really was him that should be fully credited, or in this case, just partially credited for Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, it does make it tough when you don't know for sure who does what. And that's why I said earlier, I give credit, a cinematographer, but I also give some mild credit to the director, because sometimes the director will guide them, I want this or that. I always like to, it's hard to say who did most of what or whatever, but Michael Reed as the cinematographer definitely did an excellent job.
Oh, yes. And that movie should have gotten an Oscar for cinematography. It's one of those films you watch like 60 movies that calendar year that came out that calendar year, and it's the one movie that stands out. And you sit back going, this should win cinematography. Lord of the Rings did that, the first movie in the series. I'm in the theater and I'm watching, and halfway through the film going, my God, this is going to win best cinematography of the year. And of course it did, because you really felt you were in a whole nother world. The cinematography was fantastic. in this case, if it didn't win that year, and I'd have to look it up, it should have gotten that, because I can't imagine a film coming out that same calendar year that deservedly should have gotten the best cinematography of the year.
Yeah, I can't think of any. Well, I'd have to look it up, like what movies came out in 69 and like what won and what didn't win to figure it all out. I don't think it won because I didn't see it listed as an Oscar winning movie or and that kind of stuff. So it's hard for me to tell from what I've looked on Wikipedia, which, you know, we all know is the end all be all of knowledge.
Yeah, I laugh. Yeah, I can't laugh or I'll just cough. But there's humor in the Wikipedia. It's funny. Most of the Bond movies, the big central focus is the song. And to be fair, they've had a huge track record for best song of the year. And mainly because there's always songs written vocally that's created for movies. But with Bond, it's almost like instinctively necessary for that to actually be in the movie. So it's almost not even, it doesn't even have to blend with, in this case, it works with the theme, with John Barry's music score. But sometimes, like, I don't know, I like Alicia Keys, but she did Quantum of Solace, and she co-wrote and co-sung that song, and it's out of place. It doesn't fit with the movie. And yet I'm sitting there going, I don't get this one. But, you know, it's almost a matter of having to be best song of the year, not best song for the motion picture. So they've got a track record for that. I'll give them credit. But cinematography, I think the Bond movie should have won a lot more Oscars than they have.
Oh, yes. And this is also, a lot of times when there's a Bond song, it's done at the opening credits and not in the movie itself like this one is. So I think that, right. I think this one, like you said, it fits the tone, it fits the movie better than most, you know, and cause like I said, most of the Bond songs I can remember being done are done in the beginning, opening credit part. I'm not a Bond expert, so there might be another one or two that are done in the movie itself also, which you know, it could very well be. But this one definitely fits the tone.
Yeah, I know John Barry did three songs for this one. And the one with Louis Armstrong is the one that they chose because he actually made his score, the orchestra score, and it's in many of the Bond movies, will match the song that opens the movie. Depending on how you look at it in the timeline, most Bond movies, the music used in the opening is actually the full song. So you're talking 3 to 4 minutes for opening credits, which most movies don't do. More importantly, today they do what I call music videos. It's like watching Guardians of the Galaxy, and they'll have a song playing in the background as they're doing a fight sequence. Well, I call that a music video in a sense. It can work with the action versus having orchestral score, but it just depends. For Guardians, they set it up where they can play songs on little iPads and audio cassette players. In most movies, it does not work, in my opinion. So for Bonds, I think they always wanted a popular song. It's always a new song. But they never wanted it in the movie itself unless it's part of the orchestral score. So it's only in the opening and closing credits.
Yeah, correct. And I'm really like yourself. When you said you watched it when you were a lad, you didn't enjoy it as much. Like I said earlier when we started this talk about Her Majesty's Secret Service, I was the same way when I saw it when I was young. It didn't fall into the template I was expecting. You know, because I grew up with the Roger Moore being Bond, and when I was seeing the George Lazenby's and the Sean Connery movies, I was seeing them after they'd already been out for a long time. So Roger Moore to me was Bond, and then you get thrown these curves with the other part. But now, having rewatched it, I could really appreciate this movie. You can see why it's gotten a revival in the critical eye compared to what it used to be in the past.
Correct. And it's a film of its time period where it really is transcending. The Bond films before that were of the 60s, where it was a 60s Cold War spy flick. And then you get to the 70s, and it's almost the same as 70s, 80s. You get to Roger Moore, and there are different type of Bond films. They're almost more like modernized, not Cold War era. And films, I would say the spy films evolved over the years. So this is almost like the transition from one type of James Bond movie into the next. In fact, the ones after this, I think, was Diamonds Are Forever. And that's still not a normal Sean Connery Bond movie. It's almost slightly different, like they're trying to modernize it in a sense, like they would go with next with Live and Let Die with Roger Moore. So I've always said the 60s spy films, the Cold War era, had their own flavor as opposed to the ones that would later be done in the 70s, but there'd be so many less movies made of spy films in the 70s. So this kind of closes and rounds out, I would say, probably the last great spy film of the 60s, not because it came out in December 69, just of that era. It's probably the last great one before it was going to evolve. Even Bond movies moving forward are going to be different. I don't know if they're going to do a female Bond, if they're going to bring in Idris Elba to play it. To be fair, they did Daniel Craig, and they did their own five-movie storyline of sorts, and story arc, and I thought, that works. This is great. So there's always going to be something different, but half of the ownership is now Amazon, so now you have a different group. So I don't think Bonds are going to be the same. They're going to have your classic Bonds. You're going to have your 80s Bonds for a generation. They're going to use the name, but I don't know how much. It's still going to continue, but I think the era of the classic Bond may be gone now, and this might be the highlight of that era.
Well, we can only know in the future, you know, and that kind of stuff. But I want to thank you, Martin, for spending time with me to talk about Honor Majesty's Secret Service and the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. I want to remind everybody, it's this September 7th through to September 9th, 2023, in Hunt Valley, Maryland. Go to MidAtlanticNostalgiaConvention.com, and you can learn more information. I'll also have a link in the show notes so people can just go click and go right to it, and you can get tickets ahead of time. And if you're coming from out of town, you could stay at the hotel. If the hotel's booked, there's hotels nearby that you can also stay at that are very short distance to the Hunt Valley Hotel.
Yeah, it's a fun time. The one compliment I get, and I get it a lot, is people who have never been there and keep saying for years. There's some people who say, oh, I've been meaning to come to your show. And after 15, 20, almost 20 years now, I say to myself, and they're not coming, they're just being nice and polite, and it's no big deal, you know, I'm sorry they're missing out on the fun. But then there's the occasional one or two a year who show up who've always been meaning to. They just retired, they've got free time, something came along in the regional area, and they said, I can hit both on the same time, this would be great. And the comments I'll hear is, my buddy and I came for one day, or I'll see them at another show, and they go, my buddy and I came for the first time for one day, and man, we're coming next year. We both agreed we're coming for the whole weekend. We didn't realize what all was there. And it's no matter what you tell them, no matter what they see on the website, it really is more than they expect they're going to see. And then when the weekend or the day is over, it becomes their new, their new pleasure for the year after. It's like a mini vacation. So that's the compliment I get, and that has to be the highest form of compliment I could ever receive at the convention.
All I can say is, I've said this many times, I have a good time every time, and every time the next convention is the next best convention, because it's always something new and different, but you also get to meet some people that you get to see over and over again and develop some friendships.
Yes, and there's a lot of people I know who go to our show from Canada, New Jersey, who meet up with each other every year, and they call it a family reunion where nobody's related. But it's definitely the family reunion of the year, because there's other conventions. They could be doing it at other shows. And some of them, like the ones I just mentioned from New Jersey, they go to probably 7, 8, 9, 10 shows a year, conventions. And they choose to meet up with all their friends at our show, not the other shows. And I think it's because their other friends also love our show more than the others. So it's a compliment. But that's the best thing that we could have done, is unite people together with a common interest.
I'm not going to argue with you there. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Again, leave us feedback at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com, or leave us a message on our Facebook page. You can reach out to Martin Grahams on their Facebook page. He's always checking it, you know, and responding within a reasonable amount of time, depending on what's going on. And you can also go to the website to keep an idea of what guests are coming, because like I said, Haley Mills, that was announced just literally a couple days before we're recording this. So that was just like, wow, it was a really fun email to get, and an exciting email.
He's a sweetheart. So we're giving people an opportunity. I've always said, when someone goes, well, I live in New North Carolina, I wish they'd come to North Carolina. My response is, dude, we're in Maryland. You're not in California. Sincerely, if you're in North Carolina, make it a trip, because if we're flying them in from England and Australia, the chances of them being in North Carolina again, let alone in Maryland, you know, we're bringing them to you. Here's your chance. So don't hold back.
This is your opportunity. You know, it's a reasonable distance to go depending on what state you're in and that kind of stuff. I said, I know a lot of people are jealous. I'm lucky. I'm 15 minutes away. So I'm kind of partial that it's a convention I love that's really close to home. But there's other conventions I've gone to where I drive, you know, because there's certain people I want to see. And I know you might have them, but you never know what the future is going to hold. So if there's somebody you really want to go see and meet, sometimes you got to just bite the bullet and go out there and do it.
Yeah, I remember a guy, I saw him, I don't know his name, I see him once or twice a year. He's an attendee at an antique toy show and on the fairgrounds, and we were there. You know, our Hope Convention Hotel is 10 minutes from the fairgrounds. So he comes over and he goes, hey, I'm interested. I don't know if I'll be able to get off work. I really would love to see Nicholas Hammond. And he goes, but I just saw that you rose your admission from 20 to 25. And I said, well, it's the first time in 14 years, but expenses go up. And he goes, oh, yeah, I know that. But, you know, at $25, I just want to meet Nicholas Hammond. And I looked at him and I said, you know, airfare alone, not even hotel and food expenses, to have him there for 2 days instead of three, just even 2 days is $3,000. He looked at me and I said, I'm pretty certain $25 is a bargain, dude.
It is. It's just a matter of everybody looking at it in different perspectives. And also, what can you say? I mean, he's right there. You can go see him, do it. And I know there's other conventions that are in the Hunt Valley area that I've gone to before. I've seen prices before, and their prices are significantly higher and that kind of stuff. So it's, and even
the
then,
other advantage,
the money goes to St. Jude's.
Yeah, and I know the other advantage is most conventions, a little newsflash, most conventions, it costs more to get autographs and photos with the stars. And if you go to a Comic Con, for example, I remember someone complaining he paid $100 to have his photo taken with Christopher Lloyd. And I said, did you pay him $100? He goes, yeah, I wanted my photo with him. And I said, well, that's why he charged. And he goes, well, if he was at your show, would he charge $100? Because none of your people who have been at your show have ever charged $100. And I said, no, he wouldn't charge more than $40 or $50. But even then, if he wouldn't budge, I wouldn't have him at the show. For us, a lot of convention promoters, not all of them, but a lot of them, they get a piece of the action. So the end result is they're forfeiting whatever control they did not know they had in the aspect of getting some money off the autograph. So if a star normally charges, say, $40, the club would charge $50 because the convention promoter is getting $10 for each autograph sold. It's a cruel thing, but it's a business. And at our show, we regulate the pricing. We tell them they can't charge more than $40. If they do charge more than $40, it's because they charge a lot more elsewhere, and I talk them down to $50. But in most cases, like Haley Mills, when I talked to her on the phone, I said, by the way, we have a regulation on the pricing at shows. And she goes, oh, I don't care about pricing. And I said, so $30 is fine. She goes, oh, yeah, $30 is fine. Heck, if they bring my book and they want me to sign it, I won't charge them for it. Be glad they bought my book and read it. And I said, fair enough. And I called up a friend or two and said, yeah, she ain't going to be expensive. We got that made. But how many conventions would do that? So we do run the event for the benefit of the fans.
And that's what I appreciate. And I want to thank you again for joining me on the show. All right. I hope everybody enjoyed that episode where we talk about the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention and on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And again, remind everybody, September 7th through the 9th, 2023, Hunt Valley Delta Marriott at Hunt Valley, Maryland will be the convention. And again, you can go to MidAtlanticNostalgiaConvention.com. It'll also be in our show notes with the link there. As always, you can send us feedback at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a message on our Facebook page. And to end this episode, we're going to listen to Louis Armstrong's song that we talked about. Have a good day. Bye.
We have all the time in the world, time enough for life to unfold all the precious things love has in store. We have all the love in the world. If that's all we have, you will find we need nothing more. Every step of the way will find us with the cares of the world far behind us. We have all the time in the world just for love, nothing more, nothing less, only love. Nothing more, nothing less, all